Even if you would not touch street drugs with a 10-foot pole, you get used to hearing the names in the news. Cocaine, methamphetamine, OxyContin, heroin. Those seem to go in and out of favor with drug abusers. But the name fentanyl was little known by most people until just a few years ago. And then a series of deaths caused by the drug, some the deaths of famous people, gave it what seemed like overnight notoriety. Our guest this hour started researching what happened. Ben Westhoff is the author of Fentanyl, Inc., How Rogue Chemists Are Creating the Deadliest Wave of the Opioid Epidemic. Ben Westhoff is an investigative reporter who started out on alternative weeklies in Los Angeles. Since then, he's published pieces in the Wall Street Journal, Vice, and more. Ben wrote two previous books, Original Gangstas and Dirty South. Hi, Ben Westhoff.
Thanks, Jeff, for having me.
So how did you get from two books about rappers to this book about a drug?
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, I used to be writing about music in Los Angeles, and I was covering the rave scene, where they would have these big electronic dance music parties with tens of thousands of people, and someone always died at one of these raves. And I looked into it. They died from ecstasy, I was told, but I didn't know ecstasy to be a particularly lethal drug. And so what I found out was that almost all ecstasy was adulterated. And so I went down a rabbit hole trying to find what these adulterants were. And it turns out there were this whole new crop of drugs, hundreds of them, being made out of China. They were made synthetically in a lab, and the most dangerous of them is fentanyl.
And so give us the broad overview, if you would, Ben. How did this drug seem to come out of nowhere in the last 5 years?
Well, fentanyl is the drug most people don't want. It's a substitute for heroin, except whereas heroin has to be grown from the poppy plant in a field, it's expensive, it takes a long time, fentanyl can be manufactured in a lab synthetically. It's super cheap, and it's super potent. It's 50 times stronger than heroin. And so drug dealers, to make money, to make more money, they cut fentanyl into the heroin, and then they sell it as heroin, even as they're putting fentanyl in there. And so therefore, a lot of people who buy what they think is heroin actually get fentanyl in it, and it kills them immediately.
Wow. So it does have prescription uses. I noticed patches, even lollipops for people already addicted. Is it often prescribed anymore?
Yeah. Ironically, fentanyl is a really important hospital drug still. It was invented in the late 1950s by a Belgian chemist, and it was used for open-heart surgery. And even now, it's given to women during childbirth as epidurals. It's given to men before they get colonoscopies. And like you said, there's a patch for chronic pain. And so it's an important medical drug, but at the same time, as you mentioned, the fentanyl that we always hear about in the news, this is not the hospital variety. This is the kind that's made illicitly in China.
Okay, so this is not the legit stuff on the loose. It's stuff that is made completely not in the legitimate means category.
Yeah, exactly.
So you were talking about how it's often cut into heroin. I was surprised to see it's even cut into things like cocaine and other stimulants.
Yes, it is. A lot of cocaine has fentanyl nowadays. Meth has fentanyl. And even prescription pills that look legitimate often don't have the drug that they say they have. So, for example, the singer Prince thought he was taking a Percocet pill, and it looked exactly like Percocet, but it was actually a fake pill that was cut with fentanyl, and that's how he died.
So there's a story early in your book of people hooked on opioids in the Portland area in Oregon taking fentanyl, and it's sort of an illustration of how strong this stuff is. What did it do to these people who were experienced drug users?
Well, the problem is that you can be addicted to heroin for decades, and sometimes people are, but the whole market has changed so dramatically that a lot of users don't even realize that it's no longer just heroin they're getting. And fentanyl is so much stronger that it drops someone's heart rate and it literally stops the heart beating. And when fentanyl is mixed with other drugs like Valium and Xanax, those are called benzodiazepines, and those have that same effect. They also lower the heart rate. And so when these kind of downer drugs are mixed together, that's especially fatal.
Now, the people who got knocked on their backs, as they describe it, in Portland from taking fentanyl are connected to some of the others we meet early in the book through something called Operation Denial. Tell us about that and what it uncovered.
It all started with the death of an 18-year-old boy, a recent high school graduate from North Dakota. And he died from fentanyl, and he got it from a friend who bought it on the dark web. So the dark web is this sort of disguised internet protocol where people can buy and sell drugs anonymously. But the feds cracked the case, and they traced it back to this guy from Portland, and his name was Brandon Hubbard. And he and his girlfriend were buying fentanyl through this kind of complicated scheme from China, and it only cost them a few $1,000s. It cost almost nothing, but they were able to make huge profits reselling this fentanyl to people around the country, and that included this boy who died in North Dakota.
Ben, fentanyl is in a category known as NPS. What's that mean, and what else is in that category?
It stands for novel psychoactive substances, and basically it just means drugs you haven't heard of before. So unlike classic drugs like heroin, marijuana, cocaine, these are all drugs that come from natural plants. But these new drugs, NPS, don't come from plants. They're almost all made synthetically in a lab. And so what's the difference with being able to make these drugs in a lab is that whenever a government bans one of these drugs, all the chemists have to do is just tweak the formula. So these rogue chemists, they just have to change the molecular formula of the drug a tiny bit, and now they've got something that's just as potent or more potent than the old drug, but it's now legal. And so that's how fentanyl started to spread, and that's also how drugs like synthetic marijuana, which is better known by names like K2 and Spice, that's how so many varieties of those drugs have spread also.
I guess I didn't realize until I read your book that that K2, Spike, the synthetic alternatives to marijuana don't tend to show up on drug tests seeking cannabis.
Yeah, and that's why they're so popular, where sometimes parents will give kids drug tests, and sometimes employers will give their employees drug tests, and marijuana will show up, but this synthetic marijuana, like K2 and Spice, would not show up on drug tests. It still doesn't, and so that's a big reason why it's popular. A lot of people don't really like this stuff. You know, while marijuana makes you kind of calm and maybe you have the munchies, synthetic marijuana makes your heart race really fast, and it causes overdose and death.
Wow. So you were talking earlier before the break about Brandon Hubbard, who was he and a partner were engaged in a major buying and selling of fentanyl operation in Portland. But at the other end of that transaction is China, and Zhang Zhang was named in the case, but not arrested. I mean, how different are the laws in China about this kind of activity?
You're totally right about that. When this kid from North Dakota, the 18-year-old kid, died, this big multi-state, multi-country operation arrested people all the way up the ladder, starting with Brandon Hubbard in Portland. But then once they got to the very top of the ladder, they couldn't do anything. And that's because the person who manufactured and distributed these drugs was a Chinese national. And because of China's laws, China has no extradition treaty with the U.S. So they're not going to send him over. And in fact, they said they were annoyed that the U.S. was sort of even getting involved. And they said they were conducting their own investigation, but that they hadn't found this guy had done anything wrong.
I get the sense that many authorities are stumbling in the dark, that there's still a lot they don't understand about fentanyl and the other NPS.
That's definitely true. And I went to China. I went undercover, and I visited some of these labs, and I started to kind of understand how the culture works there. And part of the problem is that a lot of these drugs are legal in the in China, but they're illegal in the U.S. And so a lot of the labs, these owners, lab owners, are just businessmen. They're not cartel dealers. They're not, you know, they don't have guns. They're just trying to make money. And so while there is this discrepancy between what's legal in China and what's legal in the U.S., these Chinese companies can export all these drugs to the U.S. with basically no consequences.
Ben Westhoff is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Fentanyl, Inc., How Rogue Chemists Are Creating the Deadliest Wave of the Opioid Epidemic. There's a history lesson you get into in the book about the fact that opiates, which come naturally from the poppy, and opioids, which are synthetic, have been present throughout American history, used for a number of different issues with pain. But as you point out, the medical establishment's approach to pain management changed in the 1990s. How did it change?
Well, previously, doctors were very loath to prescribe opioids unless it was really needed, because opioids and opiates were thought to be very addictive. And so that all began to change in the 90s, and there was a new school of thought, which was that pain should be considered the fifth vital sign, meaning that someone's level of pain was something that needed to be addressed and gotten under control. So doctors started asking patients, you know, what is your level of pain on a scale of 1 to 10? And if patients said they were, an 8 or a 9, doctors began prescribing them more and more opioids. And so at the same time, companies like Purdue Pharma, who make OxyContin, started these aggressive marketing campaigns saying that these opioids weren't really that addictive, that OxyContin wasn't really found to be that addictive. And so doctors started hearing all this and started prescribing more and more opioids. It turns out that companies like Purdue Pharma were not disclosing even their own information. They'd done their own internal studies that showed much higher rates of addiction, but they kept this information under wraps. And what happened was huge numbers of patients, when their pills ran out, they found themselves still addicted. And so many of them turned to street heroin, which satisfies the same urgings. So that was the second wave of the opioid crisis. The pills were the first, and now fentanyl is the third wave of the opioid crisis.
So this is kind of a chicken and egg question, and I apologize on that basis, but from your research, did the medical establishment change its approach to pain because the drugs are available, or did the drugs become available because of the change in the approach by the medical establishment?
I think it was sort of, you know, like you said, a chicken and the egg thing. I think they both happened at the same time. There was this obscure letter written to the New England Journal of Medicine about a study in which a doctor concluded that they'd given his patients tons of these narcotic pain pills, opioids, and not too many people were getting addicted. And so this was literally a one-paragraph letter that this doctor wrote to the New England Journal of Medicine. And his findings weren't, you know, peer-reviewed or anything, but this letter was cited hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times, including by the pharmaceutical industry, as evidence that these pills weren't addictive, when in fact there was not that evidence at all.
You know, the strength of fentanyl, you mentioned already, about 50 times as strong as heroin. And then we had some people in here who have a naloxone giveaway program in the Rogue Valley previous to this interview. And they were describing a case in which one person had to get 7 doses of naloxone to fight off the effects of fentanyl and did survive. But 7 doses of the anti-overdose drug to be able to undo the effects of fentanyl is amazing.
Well, fentanyl is just so much more powerful. And then to make matters even worse, as I found out in my book, fentanyl is only just the tip of the iceberg because it's synthetic, because chemists make it in a lab and can manipulate the structure. There are fentanyl analogs which are even more powerful. And one example is something called carfentanil, which is usually used to tranquilize elephants. So you can imagine how powerful that is, and it's actually 100 times stronger than fentanyl itself.
So does a person using drugs on the streets have any way of knowing, A, if there's fentanyl in this stuff, and B, what kind, what variation on fentanyl it is?
There's some new technology that's helping with that. It's not there yet. To be able to tell, you know, necessarily what quantity of fentanyl is. But there's something called fentanyl testing strips. And what these are, they're these cheap tests. They kind of are like a pregnancy test in a way. You mix up your drugs, your solution of drugs. You dip the fentanyl testing strips in there. And if there's fentanyl in the mixture, you get 1 stripe on the strip. If there's no fentanyl, you get 2 stripes. And studies have shown that if users find there's fentanyl in their solution, in their drugs, they will be less likely to use it and therefore less likely to overdose. So I'm a big advocate for these fentanyl testing strips.
You know, it's kind of weird. As you point out in the book, there's no street name for fentanyl still.
There isn't much. I mean, one, you know, here and there it has little nicknames, but when you think of marijuana, there are just literally dozens and dozens of nicknames, heroin, things like that. And it goes back to the fact that a lot of people just don't even want fentanyl. They don't know it's in the drugs, and they're not asking for it by name. So it's a strange situation.
Ben Westhoff is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a well-traveled journalist who traveled a lot further to discuss and research the issue of the drug fentanyl for his book called Fentanyl Inc., subtitled How Rogue Chemists Are Creating the Deadliest Wave of the Opioid Epidemic. You can join our conversation on the Exchange. Questions, comments may abound on this particular topic because we talk about fentanyl a lot but don't know a great deal about it, but Ben helps fill in some of those gaps. 800-838-3760 to join in by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Vince in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi there. I just wanted to ask a question, make a comment. A couple of years ago, we went to Hawaii for a vacation, and we're in Honolulu the first night and found out that a tourist leaving the hotel was stabbed right in front of the hotel in a mugging. And then 2 days later, I was attacked on a beach by somebody that looked like they were high and wanted my camera. And when we reported the crime and talked to the hotel people, they said, well, you know, Honolulu has one of the highest crime rates related to drug trafficking. It's just covered with ice. It's flooded with ice. And we had never heard the term ice before. We said, what's ice? And they said, oh, it's this drug that comes from China. These labs in China are just flooding Hawaii. It's the one of the inroads into the mainland to bring this drug in. And I was wondering, is that a name for fentanyl? And the other comment I wanted to make related to your previous segment was, I'd like to recommend to you and the audience to see the film Ben is Back with Julia Roberts, talking about what families have to go through to fight drug addiction among their children, these drugs that are coming in from China. It's a wonderful portrayal by Julia Roberts.
Okay, Ben is Back. That's right. Thanks for the reminder on that, Vince. Appreciate that. And ice is actually crystal meth, isn't it, Ben?
That's right, yeah. And China is making a ton of that, absolutely. So I'm not surprised it's showing up in Hawaii.
So is that another example of a drug that's legal in China to be manufactured and possessed, but not over here?
No, meth is pretty well controlled, and so it's a little different, but meth is still a huge problem. And just when we thought in this country we had our meth problem under control, the industry actually shifted to Mexico. And so now meth is as bad as ever in the U.S., but whereas in the old days it was mainly made in middle America or, you know, in quiet places in the country, now it's mostly made in Mexico.
You trace this story of fentanyl to one guy, a Belgian chemist. Tell us about Paul Janssen and when he was doing his work.
Paul Janssen invented fentanyl in the late 50s, and he invented it from the chemical structure of morphine. He's a really brilliant guy, brilliant chemist, and he was tinkering around with the chemical structure of morphine, and he wanted something that would come on faster and would be stronger. And that's what fentanyl was and continues to be. And it was almost immediately a really successful drug in Europe. In the U.S., however, the FDA was not going to approve it for medical use in the U.S. because they were worried that it would be too addictive. That was a rare time when someone predicted the horrors of fentanyl. But what happened was, the FDA was lobbied a little bit, and it was lobbied by Paul Janssen himself, the inventor, and he convinced them that it should be a legal medical drug in the U.S. And now the company that Paul Janssen founded, Janssen Pharmaceuticals, was bought by Johnson & Johnson. And now that brings everything full circle, because today Johnson & Johnson makes a fentanyl patch. And that is for use for people with chronic pain. But Johnson & Johnson has also been caught up in the opioid legislation. They just had a big settlement in Oklahoma, and there's tons and tons of these suits all over the country. And Johnson & Johnson has also been found to have manipulated its advertising and to make their products, their opioid products, sound less addictive than they actually are.
As you point out, I mean, the subtitle of the book refers to the rogue chemists creating the deadliest wave of the opioid epidemic. I mean, this is not like making some lower-level drugs. These people seem to know something about how to manipulate the chemical elements out there. But so we get with NPS what we used to be called designer drugs. I mean, there have been efforts by the feds to clamp down over the years, but it sounds like the chemists are always about one step ahead.
Yeah, the ironic thing is that most of these drugs that we hear about that people are abusing, like fentanyl, like synthetic marijuana, all the others, most of them were made by legitimate chemists in university labs, in medical labs. And in the old days, after a scientist invented a chemical, wrote a paper about it, these papers would be stashed away in university libraries. So kind of obscure, hard to find. But in the internet age, all of these papers were published online and continue to be. And so these rogue chemists that I referred to in the title of my book, all they have to do is go on the internet, and they target specific papers, specific scientists, and they scour their chemical literature for new drugs. And these papers contain basically the recipe, the blueprint for how to make these new drugs. And so these rogue chemists take the formulas and make them themselves and start selling them to be used as drugs.
We were just talking about makers in China, about people being able to look up recipes essentially on the internet, but people also can get this stuff in the mail, through regular mail, is that right?
Yeah, it's kind of shocking that it comes through the U.S. Postal Service, DHL, FedEx, you name it. And you know, President Trump has talked a lot about cracking down on fentanyl coming through the mail from China. The problem is that there are just millions and millions of packages from China to the U.S. every month, and searching all of them is basically impossible.
You mentioned earlier in the program about going undercover and getting into a lab in China. How did you get in with Dawson Lee?
It was a lot easier to visit a Chinese lab than I thought it would be. I just started out by looking up on the internet how to buy these drugs. I just Googled buy drugs in China, and all these labs came up. I got a fake email address and pretended to be a drug dealer, and I just emailed the owners of these labs and said, I would like to see your facility. May I come and visit? And they said yes. And so early last year, I flew to China, and I went to Shanghai, where I met up with this chemist named Dawson Lee, and his company advertised on the internet. They had all types of fentanyl, all types of this synthetic marijuana. And at first, you know, he didn't totally trust me. He kept asking me if I was a journalist, but eventually I convinced him that I wasn't. I had to tell a lot of lies, but he agreed to take me to his lab, and I got a little nervous when a guy pulled up in a car. He was this kind of big, strong, beefy guy who looked like the muscle, and we drove out to the outskirts of Shanghai. When we got to the lab, I was very surprised because I was expecting maybe an underground facility with guys with guns guarding the doors. But it wasn't like that at all. It basically looked like a suburban office park. There was a fountain, you know, in front of it. And we went inside and we went up to the lab. And it reminded me of, I'm sure if you've seen the show Breaking Bad, you can get a sense of what it looked like with the glassware, with the tables, the Bunsen burners. And there were bags and bags of these fentanyl analogs. There was synthetic cannabinoids, the synthetic marijuana drying on tables in huge quantities. And I was shocked that so much of these drugs were being synthesized right here. And, they only had 5 or 6 employees at this lab, but they were shipping all over the world. And it spoke to a market that was even bigger than I could have imagined.
So there's a complaint from our side of the transaction that China is deliberately dumping fentanyl on us. Does that appear to be the case from what you've learned in your research?
One of the most disturbing revelations from my book is that not only is China failing to control this industry, but it's actually encouraging it. I could barely believe when I found out, but China offers tax incentives and other government benefits to companies like this, companies that are making and exporting varieties of fentanyl and other dangerous drugs to the U.S. And it sounds crazy, but what happened was China wanted to encourage its exports from its legitimate chemical industry, its legitimate pharmaceutical industry. And so they're offering all these tax breaks and incentives. But unfortunately, a side product is that these companies making these bad drugs that are coming into the U.S. are also receiving these benefits.
A couple of contacts from listeners, I want to pick up in here. Ken in McKinleyville sent an email, and he says, a little-known effect of fentanyl is that it often induces a bodily rigidity that makes emergency intubation and even face mask oxygenation to provide life-saving ventilation very challenging. That from Ken in McKinleyville. Thank you for that contact. Here's a phone call from Ann in Eureka. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi. I just want to let you know that it isn't just the rogue drug makers that are the problem. My aunt, who is 95, lives in the Bay Area in Redwood City, still drives a car, and she, when I was a young child in the late 50s and early 60s, she was into phenobarbital, and all her friends in the garden club and, you know, women's club and everyone else she knew was definitely into it. I was shocked as a child to hear him talk about it. And then in the 60s and 70s, it turned into Valium. They were very much into Valium. And actually, the people who were supplying these drugs was Kaiser Healthcare. She was a member of Kaiser Healthcare from then till now. And then sometime in the 80s and 90s, I'm not sure exactly when, but I know up until a couple of years ago, she was taking opioids, various opioids over the years. And it culminated in a really bad case of physical distress where she was in excruciating pain. One of the problems with opioids is they cause massive constipation, and yes. I don't want to go share your listeners out.
I had a feeling you were heading there, yes, okay.
So bad that it's just horrible, you know, to see a person going through that. And so anyway, I'm not really sure. She's still alive now, and I hope she's over that totally, but I just want to let you know, Kaiser Healthcare for what, over 50 years, 60, maybe 70 that I know of, supplied her and a lot of their friends with these, with various drugs. And they kind of got them started and then they, you know, graduated other stuff. So,
yeah, that's the big problem is that you can't make a drug. It's very difficult to make a drug with the right pain relieving properties that just works in a medical realm. You know, these drugs are also used recreationally, and scientists and doctors have been trying for decades to find something that is just satisfies the use for the medical use and doesn't jump over to the other side, but they haven't been able to find something like that.
Anne, thank you for sharing that story with us, and I hope your aunt is doing okay, and more power to her for making it to 95. When we talk about the ways in which attempts were made to crack down on the original NPS back when we called them designer drugs, as you point out, the search for makers led to a guy named George Marquardt in 1993. What was his motivation, Ben?
He was a very strange guy. This was before much of anyone at all was dying from fentanyl. But he was kind of a genius drug chemist who pretended, you know, to be a legitimate university scientist. And he looked up all the chemical literature about fentanyl. And he started manufacturing it, though, to sell on the streets as drugs. And he also claimed to be helping AIDS patients get over their pain and things like that. But ultimately, his fentanyl that he made was responsible for well over 100 deaths. And so he ended up serving a lot of his life in prison.
You know, he had no sympathy for himself getting nabbed, as you point out in the book. He figured he made his choice and he'd have to live with that. But he also had no particular sympathy for the people who bought his drugs. What did he say about them?
He said that, you know, we made our choice. We were, you know, I was a drug maker and those people were drug users. And I think that is, you know, that perspective is a little murkier now in the opioid crisis because so many people became hooked on opioids without intending to. You know, like we said before, it was because they were prescribed these pills by their doctor. And then later, when their prescriptions ran out, they turn to street drugs like heroin and fentanyl.
Well, and this is a thing that is probably more from people who started with street drugs rather than with prescription drugs. But you have a couple of people in the book saying that overdose deaths seem to increase demand for the drugs that cause the overdose, which is a little counterintuitive to most people. Why does it work like that?
A lot of long-time addicted users of heroin don't even get high anymore. All the heroin does for them is it gets rid of their withdrawal symptoms. But with fentanyl, because it's so much stronger, these people can get high again. And so when they hear that someone has overdosed on a certain batch of these drugs, they don't say, oh, I better stay away from that. They say, oh, that must be really potent, really strong. I want to have some of that.
Wow. So as people reach out for drugs, that granted, if you're looking for a painkiller, that sort of thing, you're probably not looking for something like a synthetic form of marijuana or LSD, I'm guessing.
Well, there's a lot of new research, actually, that shows that some of these strong psychedelics can have really profound effects on people. And the research is just being started on, you know, psychedelics like LSD, magic mushrooms, even drugs like ecstasy, that in the early tests are showing that they sometimes have profound effects on people suffering from things like PTSD, trauma, different addictions to bad drugs. And, you know, these are tests that are being undertaken in clinical settings, in lab settings. But so far, a lot of it's proving promising.
So where do we go with what we've learned? I mean, does it appear like inroads are being made? I mean, for one, maybe it is a sign of progress, and I'm going to put quotes around the word progress, that methamphetamine seems to be back on the rise in our region anyway, because maybe that means fentanyl is dropping off. But are there more proactive ways that people are approaching the prevalence of fentanyl?
I am in favor of an approach called harm reduction. And so, you know, all these decades of the war on drugs has really not given us good outcomes. More people today are dying from fentanyl than any drug in history. And so I think we need new approaches. And I went to Europe to study and learn about what's working there. Because in Europe, they only have a fraction of the drug deaths that we have in the U.S. And there they have something called supervised injection facilities. And what these are is a place where drug users can legally shoot up. They can use heroin or fentanyl. They can use really any drug in these facilities. And it sounds shocking, but they're overseen by medical professionals. They get clean needles, and they get support. They get addiction support and counseling. And even though, you know, it might sound shocking, something like this, to people in the U.S., there have never been a death at one of these supervised injection facilities. They have a lot of them in Canada. They have a lot of them in Europe. And there are now even, like, police chiefs in places like Switzerland who say that these supervised injection facilities, where people can shoot up their drugs legally, are the best way they have to contain crime. It's a public health benefit. They save money. And that's because, you know, when people are out on the streets, they're in kids' parks, their syringes, they're throwing them on the ground. But when they're brought into the fold, a lot of times these people can beat their addictions.
Just a few seconds left, Ben. I mean, you're optimistic that there'll be some sort of ongoing solution found, or does it all end up getting tied up in politics and decisions get reversed over time?
I am optimistic because I think the tide is turning. You know, even today, if you would have told me a Republican president would be signing criminal justice reform that shortens sentences for a lot of drug users, I wouldn't have believed you a few years ago. I think now people are starting to realize that drug use is a disease. It's not something that people should be locked up for. So I do have optimism.
Well, we certainly learn a lot in the book. Your research is very thorough. The book is called Fentanyl, Inc., How Rogue Chemists Are Creating the Deadliest Wave of the Opioid Epidemic. It's the work of the journalist Ben Westhoff. Ben, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. Take care.